Good morning. So again, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, September 13th, 2022, and we have five cases on the calendar today, all of which are scheduled for oral argument.
So we're having some feedback, I think. Yeah.
Is there a way to fix this, Aaron? Is that better? Can you still hear me? I can be loud too.
Is my light supposed to be on or off?
Your light is supposed to be off.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, you're good.
Okay, yes. So I am the presiding judge today, and I'm sitting on a panel with judges Diane Bratbold and Jeannie Cochran. And this morning we are holding these hearings in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of the arguments will be available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals website, the Judicial Branch's website. And hopefully we can fix that feedback at some point in time. With that, Marshall, please call the first case before us this morning. Counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer on the center podium, and it will reset at the beginning of your argument. I ask each of you to please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument so that our recording is clear as to who is here and who you are representing that today. So, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Tim Phillips on behalf of appellant Jacob Boucher. May it please the court, counsel. The evidence at appellant's trial was not sufficient to support his conviction because the defense presented evidence that supports a rational hypothesis that appellant was not a pedestrian on the highway. As this court stated in State versus Sam, 859 Northwest 2nd, 825, quote, in the circumstantial evidence context, when reasonable or rational inferences exist which are inconsistent with guilt, the state has not presented sufficient evidence as a matter of law. The state does not dispute that this is a circumstantial evidence case. No witness, much less an arresting officer, testified regarding the conduct that appellant was engaged in at the time he was detained. As the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in State versus Al-Nasir, 788 Northwest 2nd, 469, quote, a conviction based on circumstantial evidence warrants heightened scrutiny, unquote. This heightened scrutiny requires that this court consider whether the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the circumstances proved support a rational hypothesis other than guilt. Or, as the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in Bernhardt versus State, 684 Northwest 2nd, 465, the circumstances proved must be, quote, consistent with the hypothesis that the accused is guilty.
Sorry.
That's okay.
We just noticed that the clock has not started yet. And if we could, perhaps we could add 2 minutes to the time for respondent. Thank you.
Yeah. As the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in Bernhardt versus State, the circumstances proved must be, quote, consistent with the hypothesis that the accused is guilty and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt.
Counsel, what circumstances
prove, support your argument that a rational alternative hypothesis exists that appellant was a passenger in a car and not a pedestrian?
Thank you, Your Honor. The circumstances are five specific circumstances, and these were not in conflict with any circumstances proven by the state, and thus this court does not defer to the district court's rejection of these five circumstances. First, many people entered I-94 in vehicles associated with the protest. Second, those individuals were ordered out of their vehicles by law enforcement. Third, those individuals were not segregated from the people who had been pedestrians on I-94 with the protest. But instead, those individuals were detained with the people who had been pedestrians in one large group. Fourth, at least two, and possibly all, of the individuals who entered I-94 in vehicles associated with the protest were incorrectly cited as having been pedestrians on I-94. And fifth, and by the way, there's already reasonable doubt, I mean, completely based on those four facts. But fifth, just to put the icing on the cake, the data associated with appellant specifically included information regarding a passenger vehicle, and that was admitted in evidence at trial.
So you're referring to the citation?
Correct.
Right.
It's one thing to argue, as the state does, that the circumstantial evidence supports the state's theory. But it is another thing altogether to conclude that no other rational hypothesis can be drawn from these particular facts.
Can I ask you a question about the citation? Is there any indication in the record as to why the vehicle information is included on the citation? I didn't see any indication, but maybe I missed that.
No, there is no evidence in the record about why.
Okay, thank you.
The circumstantial evidence must do more than give rise to a suspicion of guilt. It must point unerringly or unerringly, depending on your opinion, to the accused's guilt. A review of the evidence considered in the conviction of appellant is necessary to determine whether such evidence points unerringly to appellant's guilt. And here, the only evidence implicating appellant in being a pedestrian on the highway is that Lieutenant Arthur Gear with the Minnesota State Patrol took a photograph of appellant standing on Interstate 94, and appellant received a citation. However, the state concedes that, quote, Lieutenant Gear did not personally witness how appellant entered onto the highway.
So help me out, counsel. What did Lieutenant Gear testify as to when he arrived on the scene? So when was this photo taken?
Lieutenant Gear testified that his role was simply to take the photographs one by one of the individuals who were brought to him from one large group of people who had been detained. He did not have personal knowledge of the individual's name. He did not have personal knowledge of where the person was before they were put in the large group. And again, the testimony at trial was that everyone was put into this large group from which individuals came.
Right, and I appreciate why you emphasized the large group, but I'm more interested in the scope of Gear's personal knowledge. And you explained part of it. But what I'm trying to understand is he arrived on the scene and made some observations about the group. Did he arrive before or after the arrest of the appellant?
Well, I guess it would depend on your definition of when the arrest occurred, but
yeah,
I...
That's why I'm asking.
Right. I believe that he arrived on the scene... Well, I don't want to misstate the record. I don't know the answer about whether he arrived before appellant specifically was detained in the large group, and obviously an argument could be made that appellant was under arrest prior to being detained in the large group. But the essence and the importance of Lieutenant Gear's testimony was that his role was not to observe any individual what they'd engaged in prior to being detained, but was simply to take a photograph. And the usefulness of his testimony at trial was to say, I recognize this person who I took a photograph of that day.
Right, and I'm just, my reading of the Gear's testimony is that he actually doesn't testify as to where the appellant was prior to the appellant being brought to him for a photograph. Am I right?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, that's, I mean, that to me, that seems the more significant part about what his personal knowledge is. And he was, I think, we'll see what the state thinks, but it seems that the appellant was arrested prior to that photograph being taken.
Presumably, yes.
Yeah, presumably. Okay, thank you.
So this review of the record makes it impossible to conclude that the evidence points unerringly to appellant's guilt. Indeed, there were no circumstances proven at trial from which the only reasonable inference to be drawn was that appellant was a pedestrian on the highway. As the Minnesota Supreme Court stated...
So is the only reasonable alternative hypothesis that you're presenting today that... the appellant was a passenger in a vehicle?
No, Your Honor, okay. And thank you for that clarification. Okay. I mean, that is the thrust of appellant's argument, but as stated in appellant's opening brief, there is another reasonable hypothesis, which is that appellant could have been one of the individuals, which, again, indisputably, there were individuals who remained on the grassy area, and the grassy area is not a highway, and thus, if appellant were one of the individuals in the grassy area, then that would also be a rational hypothesis other than guilt. A person on the grassy area is not a pedestrian on the highway.
And you base that on your interpretation of the relevant, let's see, definition of controlled access highway? Is that right?
No. The definition of roadway.
Roadway, okay. But I thought the district court felt it was the definition of controlled access highway that was important. Am I wrong about that?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe you're wrong, and I believe the state will argue that roadway and highway should be read as the same word. That conflicts with the presumption that we should assume that words are not insignificant, superfluous, and et cetera. A defendant is not relying on conjecture or speculation when the defendant, as appellant does here, points to evidence in the record that is consistent with a rational theory other than guilt. As in State versus Sam, the state's argument here concerns which inferences from the circumstantial evidence are most reasonable. But the standard is not preponderance of the evidence in a criminal case, and this court gives no deference to the district court's choice between reasonable inferences. For example, the district court's assertion that it is, quote, unlikely that appellant accessed the highway in any way other than as a pedestrian simply ignores the rational alternatives that we have discussed. In fact, the evidence in the record is as consistent with the theory that appellant was in a vehicle on the highway as it is with the theory of appellant's guilt. The lack of evidence proving appellant's guilt is especially telling, given that throughout the trial, not a single witness testified that appellant was a pedestrian on the highway, just that he came from the group that we've talked about.
Counsel, am I correct that in the record it shows that there were two witnesses who were in vehicles at the protest at the back of the group, and that they testified that, at least from what they observed, the vehicles at the back of the group only had... I'm just going to talk very loud. if that's okay.
Yes.
So that they had testified that, in fact, the vehicles that they were aware of only had a few passengers in them. Is that accurate?
They only spoke about one or two of the approximately 12 vehicles, and yes, you are right that one of the individuals testified that she was in a vehicle with only one other person, and the other witness testified that they were the only passenger in their vehicle.
And that the photographic or video evidence that was submitted by the state of the aerial or the drone footage showed that there were approximately 5 cars at the beginning and 5 cars at the back.
I believe the evidence indicates up to 12 vehicles, but approximately 10 to 12 would be correct.
So as we're discussing circumstantial evidence and inferences, can you explain to me why it would be a reasonable inference that Mr. Boucher was in a vehicle when so few of the people who would have been in the crowd
would have been able to be in a vehicle when you compare the number of people who could have been in a vehicle to the fact that over 600 pedestrians were located on the controlled access highway.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is a very good question. And the answer is that not only is there the lack of an arresting officer or any witness identifying Mr. Boucher as being with the pedestrian group, and so there's really nothing to even tip it to a preponderance. In this particular case, even if one were to take the perspective the court has described that, well, it's more likely than not he was with the pedestrians because there's simply more pedestrians, here there's countervailing evidence which lists a vehicle, a passenger vehicle, on the ticket that Mr. Boucher received. And the burden in a circumstantial evidence case is not simply to prove that it's more likely that Mr. Boucher was with the pedestrians. The burden in a circumstantial evidence case is different. I mean, obviously, in a criminal case, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. But setting that aside, in a circumstantial evidence case, the state has to show that there is no rational or reasonable alternative. And there were many people in vehicles, and there were many vehicles. Is there a specific number listed? No, there is not. But the number of people in vehicles was not in the, you know, 1 to 10 number. It was definitely more than that, and that creates a certain possibility, which is a reasonable possibility in light of other evidence, such as the vehicle listed on the ticket, such that it would be irrational. It would be a rational alternative.
Counsel, in your view, then, would any person that was in the group of people who were detained that included both pedestrians and passengers, for all of those individuals, is the only way that there could be proof beyond reasonable doubt? In other words, in this situation, is it your view that there would have to be testimony of a witness that viewed the person as a pedestrian on the highway in order for the person to be convicted?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for that question. So this is a very interesting topic. There would be two routes. Either the arresting officer has to testify, as the court has discussed, but the other option is for simply law enforcement to do their job, which is to keep individuals segregated. So if the large group of individuals who were detained as pedestrians was simply kept separate from the individuals who were detained on the grassy area or detained in vehicles, then no, an arresting officer wouldn't have to identify, have 646 individual arresting officers testify at 646 trials about 646 specific individuals.
But under the circumstance of this case, your argument is that for any individual in the larger group, unless an officer testified to seeing that person on the highway as a pedestrian, there's a rational alternative hypothesis that that person could have been a passenger in a car.
That is correct, and that is the fault of the law enforcement agencies that mishandled the demonstration. Yes, thank you.
I turned it on, I'm sorry, because of the interference earlier. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yes, and I'll just, no, that's completely fine. Inferences that are inconsistent with guilt create a reasonable doubt as to whether appellant was a pedestrian on the highway. Because of that reasonable doubt, this court must conclude there is insufficient evidence to support appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, counsel for respondent, when you're ready, please begin.
May it please the court. My name is Amy Tripp Steiner, Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney, appearing on behalf of Respondent, State of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that this court affirm appellant's conviction for being a pedestrian on a controlled access highway. As the court has heard, appellant advances two different theories that they assert as a rational hypothesis that is inconsistent with guilt. Now, as this court is aware, in circumstantial evidence cases, those convictions will not be overturned on mere conjecture. The court engages in a two-step process of analyzing the circumstances that were proven, giving deference to the district court's findings, and then independently examines the totality of the evidence to determine if there are any rational hypotheses that are inconsistent with guilt. The issue of the elements that were outlined by the district court, it seems to be element three, whether he was a pedestrian on that highway. And the first is that they assert that that he was possibly in a vehicle. However, when we look at the totality of the evidence, that is not a rational hypothesis. The circumstances that were proved by the district court were the following: that Major Meher testified about knowledge that this large group, that two groups converged and merged onto the on-ramp to I-94 and then proceeded to enter onto the highway. Two, that the Exhibit 3, the eight photographs that were entered from the State Patrol helicopter, show the progression of this large group of individuals marching onto the controlled access highway. That in Exhibit 3, you do have direct evidence that there were five lead marshal vehicles and five rear marshal vehicles. Third, the testimony provided that anyone who was on the controlled access highway was encircled and brought to law enforcement for the purpose of identification and citation. And five, that Lieutenant Gere personally testified he recognized appellant and took the picture that was entered as Exhibit 4. Now, the fact that there were these 10 vehicles that had some individuals in them does not rise to the level of being a rational hypothesis. We know that there were 10 vehicles from the direct evidence of Exhibit 3. The rational inferences is that each of those vehicles would have had one person. They all would have needed a driver. The testimony in the actual record from appellant's witnesses indicated that in the rear, two of those vehicles were occupied with two people. Otherwise, there was no other evidence that these vehicles were occupied multiple times over.
Why is it rational to assume that there was only one person in each vehicle, absent testimony of passengers?
Well, each vehicle would have needed, Your Honor, someone to be driving it. Mm-hmm. And then when we look at the totality of the evidence, there is no other evidence that these vehicles were occupied multiple times over. And so we have to look at what the actual record is and evaluate that for the rational hypotheses. And so the only rational hypothesis is from the actual evidence in the record is that there were up to 12 individuals who were in these vehicles. And so when we then look at Exhibit 4, which was from the district court, is an actual picture of what appellant looked like that night. And what you can see is that he's wearing a jacket, a hoodie, and wearing gloves. So the rational inference when we're looking at the totality of all the evidence in there is that this large group of over 600 people had marched onto the freeway, that appellant is dressed in a manner to be a pedestrian on November 4th, 2020. The rational inference is not that he was one of those 12 individuals who was on the who was in a vehicle, but it is more consistent in the reasonableness is that he was a pedestrian. Further, appellant advances that the information on Exhibit 7, which was that citation, is a rational hypothesis that he was a pedestrian or that he was a passenger in a vehicle.
Counsel, before you go ahead to the citation, let me just ask you about your emphasis on the number of vehicles and the lack of evidence about the number of people in vehicles. So that is not mentioned, at least not that I see, in the district court's analysis of the evidence. Am I right about that? The district court relies on two pieces of evidence to determine that the appellant was a pedestrian. Isn't that right?
The court discusses it doesn't do it as clearly and as with emphasis that I am doing it at this time, Your Honor. But when we're talking about that second part of how this court is to evaluate that circumstantial evidence, whether the district court analyzed it the same way is not relevant. You get to do an independent examination
I understand.
Of that.
Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify, I mean, your approach is quite different from what the district court took, isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Yes. All right.
The citation information, as was noted earlier, there was no contextual evidence as to how that information got on there, if that vehicle was even on scene. The record indicates that the state had noticed 20 minutes prior to the hearing that the appellant was intending to enter that exhibit and objected vehemently to its introduction. It was insufficient amount of time for the state to try to obtain additional evidence of who issued the citation to talk about how that was there. But what the record does indicate is that those citations were issued by mobile units from the state patrol. And so what we don't have here is any connection. It is not a reasonable inference or rational hypothesis that just because a citation lists some vehicle data, something that was issued roadside by a state patrol trooper.
So what does it mean, counsel, if it's not rational to infer that that's the appellant's vehicle? What is it rational to infer? Why in the world is that listed?
We would have to speculate. And if we're going to speculate, then it's conjecture.
Well, no, I mean, we have had a proposal that, I mean, and all of us have received citations. There's some common knowledge here, right?
Right. Yeah,
so.
But if that's the state would be then saying that if you're getting a citation from a state patrol trooper roadside and they're going to run your name, the logical, it's equally likely that it's going to attach to any vehicle information you may have when you pull that, when they run your.
Well, that's the inference you would draw.
That would be the reasonable
okay.
inference. But again, without there being any direct testimony at the hearing, you have these two different inferences, neither of which carries any more weight because there was no contextual evidence about the value of that information on there, especially when we look at the totality.
So it includes the vehicle license as well. I did look at it at one point, but I forgot. Is that right? The citation?
It has vehicle information on there, and I could look to the last page of appellant's addendum. I believe that is where it is.
Well, I know we have it in the record.
Yes, it does have a license plate information on there. But what we have as evidence in the record is that you had a group of over 600 individuals, that we have photographic evidence of this large group coming in. We have testimony from the major who testified that anyone who was found on the controlled access highway was encircled, identified, and cited.
Anyone, including the drivers, and if there are passengers of the vehicles, right?
That did come out correct.
Okay.
But as we've talked about before, the number of individuals from the actual evidence in the record is significantly lower than the 646 citations that were issued. And we take that and put it in context of how appellant was actually dressed and photographed at that time in November. An individual who was dressed in a jacket with a hoodie on and gloves, the rational and reasonable inference is that he was dressed to be a pedestrian and had been marching with that group and entered onto the freeway. That circumstantial evidence makes that chain complete. That is that completing, making it proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So he's dressed to be a pedestrian? Is that what you're arguing? Maybe I'm just not following.
He was dressed to be marching that night. He was dressed to be out walking about. It's not a rational hypothesis that if he had been driving his vehicle, if you're driving in a warm vehicle, who's going to be dressed up in all the layers and wearing his gloves when he gets pulled out? The testimony from Ms. Galensky at the trial was that law enforcement approached vehicles with guns drawn, yelling. Is it a rational inference that if he had been driving his vehicle, he would have taken the time when being yelled at by law enforcement to grab his gloves, knowing that he's going to be standing out on the freeway at that point? None of that makes rational inferences. The rational inferences that are drawn from all of the totality point unerringly to guilt.
Did you make the argument about how he was dressed in your brief?
I did not, Your Honor.
Okay, because I thought your argument in your brief was primarily based on percentages, that the vast majority of the people in the group that was detained were protesters, and then there were a few people who were car drivers or potentially passengers. And on that basis, it seemed to be you were arguing, I'm looking at page 30 of your brief, that it's not rational that appellant arrived on I-94 in any other manner than by walking onto it. So this is a new twist that I'm hearing now, and because the argument based on the numbers alone, to me, seems to be you know, an argument that maybe goes to the preponderance of the evidence standard, but I'm not clear how the statistical argument meets the beyond the reasonable doubt standard, given that there was no testimony of any person viewing this individual walking as a pedestrian on the highway.
You're right, Your Honor, this argument wasn't contained in the brief. However, because as this part of when the court is analyzing, you get to look independently at everything, and it was getting ready for the argument that when I printed it out. And while the percentage is not the only thing, and honestly, the math that was done in the state's brief is probably high because that was based on an assumption of 48 individuals, but when we think about it, that there is no, it's not undisputed that 48 people were in those vehicles, right? But we have to look at the totality of all of the evidence and look at are the inferences that are being made reasonable and rational in light of all of that. And when we look at everything, you have the direct evidence that 646 citations were issued. You have the direct evidence from law enforcement that they encircled anyone that they found on what they defined as a controlled access highway, which I will address that definition issue in a moment. And you have the direct evidence that appellant was found on part of that encirclement. And then we have, while there's the possibility that was advanced, that is conjecture based on the fact that we didn't have that appellant's own witnesses didn't place him in there. And while the appellant bore no burden of proof during that trial, the evidence still does not point unerringly to him being in one of those vehicles or be even a rational hypothesis.
Counsel?
Yes.
So you're emphasizing now that the way he was dressed, that we should infer from that he was a pedestrian. Why isn't it also reasonable to infer that in Minnesota, in November in Minnesota, it's very cold, and you get into your car, it may or may not be warm, you might have to jump out, you keep your gloves and your jacket on.
And that can be, Your Honor. Most of us have all lived here for a long time. But when we're looking at, is it the rational that if we're going to rely on the citation, which is listed as 7, if the inference is to be that he was driving his own vehicle, okay? And then the inference was that he was dressed that warmly for however long. You heard the testimony of Major Meher is that we had two groups that were working together for a long time. To be sitting for periods of hours in a vehicle completely bundled up isn't exactly what most of us would reasonably infer that when we're driving. If we're going to be sitting in our vehicle for an extended period of time in Minnesota when there's no snow on the ground, maybe we're not going to be wearing our gloves the whole time. But when we're looking at the evidence that was in the record, we have evidence of over 600 individuals that you can see on Exhibit 3 marching onto the freeway. And then we look at how is appellant presenting at the time from that incident. He is dressed up. The reasonable inference is that he was a pedestrian.
And I have two more questions about the record. Is there any information in the record about how many of the 640-some people who received citations, that their citation also included vehicle information?
The record is devoid of that. There is nothing in there about other people's citations and what was on there. And that record doesn't exist here. I'm trying to be careful because I've handled these other ones and I don't want to say what's happened in other cases. But this record does not contain what other people's citations included.
Okay. And then kind of turning to the issue of whether he may or may not have been on the grass and whether that's a rational inference, if you could just speak to whether we've identified how many of the people who received tickets were on the grass. Is that in the record at all?
The record does not indicate how many of the individuals were on the grassy abutting area or the paved portion. The states of the opinion and position based on statute and definition that is not a relevant fact. Whether the individual was found on the grassy area or the paved area all falls under the area that's defined as a controlled access highway. The testimony from both the lieutenant and the major that their understanding that a controlled access highway included the grassy areaway is consistent with law. Now, back in 1959, the Minnesota legislature created Chapter 439, and created Minnesota Statute 169.305, Subdivision 1, which authorized the then Commissioner of Highways, now the Commissioner of Transportation, with respect to any controlled access roadway under their jurisdiction to prohibit the use of such roadways, referencing controlled access roadways, by pedestrians and other types of vehicles and traffic. The next year, the commissioner then issues a control use order, and the first thing it states is pursuant to the laws of Minnesota 1959, Chapter 439. So it's referencing immediately back to controlled access highways. It's very specific. And then talks about those main roadways, always referencing back to that controlled access highway. When we look at what the definition of a controlled access highway, it has not changed since 1959. While it's changed in number, the wording did not change. And as it's currently defined and is relevant to this appellant, it is 169.011, Subdivision 19. And it talks about every highway, street, or roadway, including the abutting lands and any where it's been acquired.
So you skipped some words there, counsel. And I noticed that in your brief, too. So at least the definition I'm looking at, unless I've got the wrong one, does it go straight to including abutting lands?
It talks... So we have every, I can go through it directly, and it's still, yeah, and the state is of the same position that it includes the abutting lands. Every highway, street, or roadway in respect to which the right of access of the owners or occupants of abutting lands and other persons has been acquired, and to which the owners or occupants of abutting lands and other persons have no legal right of
talking
access.
Talking about owners and occupants of abutting lands, and it's talking about legal rights of access,
but
it's not saying highway, street, or roadway, including abutting lands. I don't see that. And you're right, that's the way the district court read it. I just don't see it in the statutory definition.
Your Honor, after it says owners or occupants, and it says, and other persons have no legal right of access.
Right. It is talking about owners and occupants of abutting lands and other persons has been acquired. It's talking about the persons. Look at the prepositions.
It doesn't make sense that I've ran out of time.
Is that all right?
Yes, please.
I would love to hear your interpretation
please
of this definition.
Answer.
Yes, thank you.
So when you read that in conjunction with 160.02, which is, again, about how the state, as the commissioner, has the ability to control, it says that other persons have no right or access. And so we're talking about that you have these, it's not just a roadway, the controlled access highway, and using this abutting lands. And while it's talking about owners and persons, the abutting lands, the state has the ability to control the access. It is not, that is maintained by that area. Who is it maintained by? By the commissioner. That area is not open and obvious for pedestrian travel. You have no person who would be traveling in a wheelchair would say, that is the right way for me to go. And so when you look at what the commissioner is authorized to do, is they're allowed to control the access and determine where and when individuals can access the roadway and in which manner and what type of traffic it may use. So in this situation, it has prohibited pedestrian travel on controlled access highways, and that it would not make sense that would allow for individuals to go onto these abutting lands when they have abutting lands referenced in this statute, for them to be using that as a thoroughway next to a controlled access highway where vehicles are traveling at 55 miles an hour, when we have other definitions in other places that allow for regular roadways that do allow for pedestrian travel. I have run out of time. I will stay if the court has further questions. Otherwise, if there are no further ones, the state respectfully requests for this court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And the clock will start when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the interesting topics here is whether we're talking about there only being one reasonable alternative? Is there only one reasonable narrative that we're required to pick, or are there multiple rational alternatives? And all of the case law that both sides have cited indicate that there are multiple rational alternatives. We don't need to pick the one most reasonable, which is what the district court did, unfortunately. With regard to the vehicle on the ticket, why in the world is that listed? That is a great question. And obviously, there is not evidence in the record about why it was listed, but it was interesting to hear the state's argument that potentially this auto-populates. Well, certainly that is potentially a rational alternative, but it is also a rational hypothesis that it does not auto-populate. And as the state said, two inferences, neither of which carries more weight. It's not rational when talking about the vehicles to assume that there's only one passenger in each. Would it be reasonable as an alternative? Certainly, it's one reasonable alternative that there may be one driver of each, and it may be a rational alternative that there could be more. There's simply not evidence to say one way or the other whether there was more than one, except there was testimony that there was more than one from one of the witnesses.
So, oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it's. I hear the state arguing that what you're doing right now is pure speculation because there isn't evidence in the record. And you seem to be agreeing that there is no evidence in the record as to what, for instance, on the citation, the listing of the vehicle.
And just like the conversation previously, we discussed this, the law enforcement mishandling. The reason there is not evidence in the record about how many people were in all the vehicles is that the state did not present that evidence in attempting to prove appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not appellant's burden to prove how many people were in each vehicle. If the state fails to present any evidence on that topic, it's certainly possible. It's not a stretch to imagine that there's more than one person in vehicles when we're talking about,
Well, the state did establish the number of citations that evening and that certainly almost all of them were pedestrians.
And almost all is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, that's just simply not the standard.
What is, if it's not, if almost all gets to 90% or something like that, is that beyond a reasonable doubt?
What we do, Your Honor, is we do what you specifically stated previously, which is we use our common sense, and we ask with our common sense, based on what we know about life in this society, do we have a doubt? Do we actually have a doubt about whether appellant was in a vehicle based on all the evidence? We're not talking about other individuals who may not have had vehicles listed on their tickets. We're looking at all the evidence together, and we're just asking with our common sense, do we have a doubt? And this is, go ahead.
In that regard, can you address this, the respondent's argument that when you look at how appellant was dressed in Exhibit 4, along with the fact that most of the vast majority of the people who were issued citations, the vast majority of the people in the larger group were protesters and not in a vehicle,
thank you, Your Honor. And as the court stated, that is a new twist. That's not something that was in the briefing. I didn't have an opportunity to address that in appellant's reply brief. But again, it just goes to this concept. There's a clash of views about, are we looking for the reasonable hypothesis, or are we looking at multiple rational hypotheses? So it is equally rational to believe that either this person was dressed this way because they were planning to march, or this person put on their gloves like any rational Minnesotan would do when they have to get ordered out of their vehicle in November. I believe the testimony substantiates that these people were out on the highway for hours after they were taken out of their vehicles, and so it
does the record tell us what the temperature was that evening?
No, I don't think it does.
But the record reflects that the people were on the highway for a significant period of time before the photo. Well, is there any information in the record as to how long this individual was in the group before the photo was taken?
I don't believe so. I don't know the answer, though.
Okay, thank you.
As to the state's argument that this is some surprise evidence about the ticket, I mean, the state issued the ticket. It's the first document in the file, and it's not a surprise that this ticket would be potentially included in the evidence in the record. It's literally the first document filed in the case by the state. So there is not one, only one reasonable alternative. There are multiple. The grassy areas are not the abutting lands. Whether or not pedestrians have a right to access the highway, we're talking about the grassy areas, and whether or not it's legal to be on the grassy areas, it's not pedestrian on a highway to be on the grassy areas. But regardless, the court need not reach the grassy area because apart from that, the state did not prove appellant beyond guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here today and for providing argument and for your briefing. It's been very helpful. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And you may go ahead and gather your things, and we'll move on to the next case. Thank you.